I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. I'm pleased to have Senator Hugh Siegel back on the program. He was on nearly 5 years ago to talk about his last book, and he's got a new one. It's called The Right Balance, Canada's Conservative Tradition. In the book, he looks at Canadian conservatism throughout history, looking at the conservatism of MacDonald, R.B. Bennett, Diefenbaker, Robert Stanfield, Mulroney, and the conservatives today, chiefly Stephen Harper. I just got the book, and I'm really looking forward to reading it, because as usual, Senator Siegel has unimpeachable roots in the movement and the parties involved. He speaks his mind and informs and advises not just conservatives, but Canadians who care about the country. His previous books include No Surrender and The Long Road Back. He was a senior aide to a prime minister and two Ontario premiers. He was the head of the Institute for Research and Public Policy in Montreal, and is a member of the Order of Canada. Senator Siegel was appointed to the Senate in 2005 and sits as a conservative representing Kingston, Frontenac, Leeds. His website is at hughsiegel.ca. The Right Balance is published by Douglas and McIntyre in Vancouver today. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Hugh Siegel. Good morning, Senator Siegel.
Good morning, Joe.
Thanks for joining us. The book, as I said, I haven't finished it yet, but I'm really enjoying it. It's part history and it's also part prescription, right, for the politics in this country?
A little bit of that. It's an analysis, really, of why the conservative brand in Canada is a different kind of conservatism than we find in the United Kingdom or in Europe or in the United States, and it kind of traces how that happened. What were the contributing factors in our history, in our language discussions, in what happened during the wars, our relationship with the United States, the various things, the growth of prairie populism that changed the nature of our conservatism into something which is very unique and very Canadian. And I thought, as I believe our conservatism is quite different, I had a duty to try to explain why and how that happened, and that's really the purpose of this book.
And why do you think it is that people think that you've obviously heard of this thing about Sun TV, and people are afraid that it's going to be Fox News, and it's not Fox News, but people tend to think anything right-wing, anything conservative, anything Harper-related is automatically Republican.
Yeah, and I think that I think it's profoundly unfair, and it's also quite ahistorical. If you look at it, there's no more stout defender of universal health care than the Prime Minister, who says he and his family use universal health care. I think he's the first Prime Minister in the history of the country whose kids go to public school as opposed to private school. He's a very down-to-earth guy. When you hear about him in Ottawa, you don't hear about him necessarily at fancy events or black tie events. You hear him having taken the family out to Swiss Chalet after a hockey game in which Ben was playing. So in that sense, I think he's more rooted in the kind of everyday Main Street experience that we all go through. Secondly, if you think about the decisions that he's made, the decision on, for example, potash, not letting foreigners buy it, not letting a major aerospace company be bought by the Americans, now reviewing the issue with respect to the stock exchange in Toronto, these are not kind of blood and guts, Republican marketplace, uber-allis kinds of decisions. They do reflect balance, which is very much in the tradition of Canadian conservatism. And even the various brands under which conservatism has operated in Canada. In the West, we saw social credit, we saw reform, we saw alliance, we had liberal conservative under Sir John A. Macdonald, we had conservative unionist under Mr. Borden, Union Nationale in Quebec, different brands, but basically they reflected the same general concern about protecting the rights of average people. Remember Bible Bill Eberhardt, who was that very committed social credit leader associated with the religious right? Well, he campaigned under a banner that said reducing poverty in a time of plenty. He was very much coming out of that post-depression kind of populism where people were looking for a way to be fair to folks who were really suffering, and that was not very different from where Tommy Douglas came from. So I think those are the kinds of things it's helpful to understand, not because I'm saying our conservatism in Canada is better than the American brand or the British brand or the European brand. I'm really saying it's different, and I think we would all do well, however we vote, by understanding that difference.
And why don't we understand it? Is it the fault of the media? Is it the fault of historians, say?
Well, there's not much history, much interest in history these days, generally. If you can't send a text message about it in under 145 characters, people aren't that patient. And, of course, the media uses, and it's not because they're doing anything other than dealing with the reality they find when they're looking at news stories, but when you have four news stories in a newscast that talks about conservative forces in Iran thinking that stoning a woman for adultery makes good sense, or conservative forces in China think that censoring the internet makes good sense, or conservative forces in the Tea Party think universal health care is a bad idea, then clearly the word conservative, not inaccurately, is being used to create a mindset just by telling the truth as they may exist in that country. I think it's appropriate we understand what conservatives in Canada have stood for over the years, good, bad, or otherwise, so we have a better sense of perspective about our own system.
And the conservatism of today, the conservatism of Mr. Harper and the government that you support, has it changed, say, from generation to generation? I mean, you do this sweep of history from MacDonald to Bennett to Diefenbaker, Stanfield, yeah, and Mulroney. Each generation has had its own sort of conservatism, has it?
That's true, but you can see strains. You can see strains of what happened in previous conservative eras in some of the measures that have been undertaken now. The intervention with respect to potash and those sorts of things really reflects the nationalism of people like John Diefenbaker. Commitment to, I think we have now some 50 trade negotiations going on with independent countries across the world, with Minister Van Loan involved in that process, well, that really reflects the interest in a broader trading relationship that was very much reflected by Brian Mulroney. The focus on the North, developing the North, making sure we have the defense capacity to sustain our sovereignty up there, that very much reflects John Diefenbaker's vision of the North. So you can see the roots of a lot that is going on now in conservative history, and that's why understanding that history is actually a pretty good predictive tool for voters to understand where today's conservatives may at some point be headed.
One of the things from the press that this book has gotten that they talk about is this idea of a greater North American community. How would that manifest itself?
Well, what I've suggested when I talk about kind of what the right balance going forward should be on a host of defense, trade, and financial and economic issues, what I've suggested is because things like the environment, things like H1N1 health issues, things like the migration of people over borders looking for jobs, things like the value of currency are not issues that are within the control of any one government by itself, and because we have in the past shared our sovereignty with organizations like NATO and NORAD the North American Free Trade Agreement to achieve more economic growth, a more robust economic opportunity for people, we should be thinking about where we are in our own hemisphere. The Prime Minister has talked about us focusing more on our own neighborhood, by which I suspect he means the United States, Mexico, economic powers like Brazil and others. Now, all I'm suggesting is that we should probably try to have a white paper which lays out what some of the options are for us to work more closely with them. Is it a European-style structure? Is it something like an enhanced organization of American states, which we joined under the Mulroney administration, which is all the countries of our hemisphere, including the United States? What is the right answer? We should have that debate. We should have that discussion, because if we don't, and if we don't come up with a Canadian position, we always face the risk that others, like Brazil and Mexico and the United States, will reach their own agreements, and that'll set the terms by which we can then participate more fully. I'd like to see Canadians in on the ground floor. I'd like to see Canadians designing the kind of future we want for ourselves, fighting for our own best interests, the way we did in terms of Confederation and Sir John A. Macdonald, the way we did in terms of the development and expansion of the West, the way we did in energy markets. These are the things which I think are important. That's why I make that case near the end of the book.
And people on the left will probably say that you're recommending that we yield our sovereignty to the Americans.
Absolutely not. It's quite the opposite. You lose economic sovereignty when economic decisions that are important to you are made elsewhere. You gain economic sovereignty. Look at where we are on the trade relationship with the United States. Because of the dispute resolution mechanism built into the free trade agreement, which was Canada's fundamental condition for acquiescing and accepting that agreement, the bottom line is now we have better access than we've had in the past the protectionist forces in the U.S. couldn't keep Canadian goods out. We've had problems with lumber. We've had problems, as a huge trading relationship will have on occasion, with various other issues like potato blight and the rest. But overall, it is the most robust trading relationship in the world, and Canadians are prospering immensely from that. So it's about enhancing our economic sovereignty by making sure that the decisions that really matter are not made at tables where we are not present, and you actually use your sovereignty in support of your economic best interests when you're at the tables where the decisions are being made. And we may need some new tables. We may need some new structures that we have not had in the past. We should be open to the debate around that issue. That's the only case I'm trying to make, Joe.
Now, this is something that you recommend in the book. Where is the government on an issue like this? Is it a policy of the government yet?
No, it's not, and I don't speak for the government in this matter. The government is now focusing on bilateral trade relationships. There's been an agreement signed with Peru, one with Chile, one with Colombia. Negotiations are beginning with India. There are initial negotiations beginning in terms of some kind of partnership that might make sense with Japan. There are negotiations underway now with the European Community. The bilateral approach to specific trade agreements with specific benefits for Canadian producers, Canadian workers, Canadian investors, Canadian companies, Canadian citizens and taxpayers, that's kind of where the government's policy is. I have no idea whether it's going to change over time, but one of the nice things about this particular prime minister is that he doesn't discourage people. Cabinet ministers all have to be of one view on issues because that's the nature of cabinet government. But those of us who aren't in cabinet are encouraged to put new ideas into the marketplace. And he's been very encouraging about a whole bunch of ideas that have come on this and related issues from a whole bunch of people. But I can't give you any prediction at all as to whether this would end up being government policy. I just don't know.
Now, what is your relationship with the government? You sit in the Senate as a conservative.
I'm a member of the Conservative Caucus.
So
my leader in the Senate is Marjorie LeBreton, and my leader overall is the Prime Minister. When I was appointed to the Senate by Paul Martin, he gave me the choice of sitting as a Liberal or an Independent or a Progressive Conservative, and I said to him that I would only go if I could sit as a Conservative, because I believe in two strong competing national parties, so voters have a choice. If they're happy with one gang, they can keep them in. If they're unhappy, they can kick them out because there's someone else strong enough to form a government on their own. And he let me do that, and I now am a member of the Conservative Caucus, and I consider it a privilege to support the party. I don't support everything. I disagree on some issues, but by and large, it's a privilege to support the government and the Prime Minister.
And so you attend caucus regularly?
I attend caucus on a very regular basis, that's right, both the Senate caucus on Tuesdays and the main overall caucus on Wednesday morning.
And can you give us a view? I mean, I know you're bound by secrecy and the sort, but can you give us a view? Is there opportunity when you're in the main caucus on Wednesdays for disagreement if you're sitting with cabinet ministers and the Prime Minister even?
Joe, I have sat in caucuses under Prime Minister Mulroney, under Premier Davis in Ontario, and I want to tell you, I have never seen a caucus discussion that is more open, more broad, more no holds barred. People are very frank and very direct, whether they agree with the minister or disagree, whether they agree with the prime minister or disagree. They step up to the microphone. They're not limited in what they say, and the discussion is very broad, more open and broad than I have ever seen in a conservative caucus in the past.
You dedicate the book to Bill Davis, the former Premier of Ontario, whom you served. What did you learn from him, and what do you think that the rest of us should learn from him?
Well, an interesting question. Joe, the great thing about Bill Davis was that he believed that a province like Ontario was really a large family, and you only made it work when everybody felt that there was a chair for them at the family table. And that meant that the education system had to be expanded to provide for equality of opportunity. That meant that the healthcare system had to have the skills, the depth, the facilities, the diversity and distribution across the province so that everybody had equal access. It meant that you had to have a tax system that encouraged people to invest and take risks. And it also meant that you had to move with the times as a conservative. He came under great pressure when, as Minister of Education, he brought something into the marketplace for the first time in Canada called TV Ontario, educational TV, which is now a remarkable platform, and we have it in other provinces, a digital platform, a broadcast platform by which we can take learning to a whole new level. So So you can't be afraid of change if you're a conservative, but the change has to reflect support for the values that we all care about: opportunity, freedom, diversity, respect for family, the things that actually make a society strong. And he was very good at that. And I'll give you one little anecdote, if I may.
Yeah.
In the days of minority government, there was the estimates of the Department of Community and Social Services being addressed by the community, by the Standing Committee of the Legislature on that issue. And the NDP made a motion to reduce the salary of the minister and of the deputy minister, not by a dollar, which is the usual symbolic proposition, but to a dollar. And the reason they did that is because they thought not enough care was being taken with respect to senior, retired women whose husbands had not left very much pension in those days and were really living beneath the poverty line and were actually buying dog food and cat food to supplement the protein in their diets. And once we found out what that was about, the Premier raised the issue clearly in Cabinet and made it perfectly clear that in his Ontario, seniors should not have to worry about having enough to eat. And within 3 weeks, Darcy McHugh, one of the most conservative pinstripe finance ministers in the history of Canadian provincial government, stood and announced the guaranteed annual income supplement that seniors would get, not by filling out new forms, not by going to talk to welfare officers, but just by filling out their tax form. And if they fell beneath the number that was necessary to live comfortably with your basic needs met, you'd be topped up automatically by the system. Didn't hire one bureaucrat, but it made a huge difference. And in 2 years, we took a rate of poverty among senior women, older women in the province of Ontario, from 30% to under 3%. That's the kind of conservative he was. It was fiscally responsible. It was efficient. It helped the people who needed it. But it also made sure there was room at the family table for older women as well. And that's the kind of conservative he was, and that's why I was so honored to be able to dedicate the book to him, because I think he reflected one of the best examples of the right balance in our national history.
Indeed. A couple last things, Senator Siegel. There's the talk of an election. If it's this year, if it's this spring or this fall, what do you think Prime Minister Harper needs to do to communicate to the Canadian people so that that your party gets the majority that it's seeking?
Well, I doubt that that the government will ask for a majority. The government will ask for a mandate to get certain things done around economic performance, around job creation, around reducing the level of unemployment, around putting the deficit that was created when the Lehman Bank collapsed away and bringing our government back into balance, keeping our defense forces strong. So I think he'll ask for a mandate. Look, it's really simple. In the end, people don't vote because they agree with you on issue A or issue B or issue C. People vote for you because they think they trust you to make the right decisions in difficult times these days in circumstances that were not expected that could transpire any time, as we see by watching and listening to the news, even as we speak. And I think the way this Prime Minister handled the collapse of the Lehman Bank, the huge credit collapse, and the effect on liquidity in our economy showed the balance and the stability and the kind of core motivation that drives him, and I think that will be one of the critical issues that Canadians will want to reflect upon when they compare him to what I'm sure will be the compelling offerings of the other party leaders as well.
And in the acknowledgments in the book, you say that you use a fountain pen, and I've just started using a fountain pen myself. I'm wondering what kind you use.
Great question. I use a Schaefer. I've used a Schaefer for a very long time, and it's a great pen, and I've always written all my, this I guess is my fifth book, on fountain pen and yellow foolscap, and I have people who help me type it who've never forgiven me for that, but I've hung in there nonetheless.
I use a cross, and I'm enjoying it. And
good.
So, yeah.
Well, it's one of the great joys in life, and you know, I think the words flow on occasion when the ink flows. And I'm not sure that the digital process is quite as ennobling in that way.
Yeah. Senator, I'm enjoying the book, as I said, and we ought to talk again. Congratulations and good luck with the book.
Joe, thank you very much and all the very best.
You're very welcome. Hugh Siegel's website is at hughsiegel.ca. The book is called The Right Balance, Canada's Conservative Tradition. It's published by Douglas and McIntyre. Senator Hugh Siegel on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plante.